Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hi, my name is Natalia Churchward from the Kingdom of Tonga. This podcast is for entertainment purposes only and does not replace your own financial, tax, legal, or financial product advice.
Hi, my name is Lexi, and I'd like to start by saying, on behalf of My Millennial Money, I'd like to begin by acknowledging the Whadjuk Noongar people, traditional custodians of the land on which we meet tonight. We pay our respects to elders, past, present, and emerging, who may be joining us tonight.
That's right, people. We are coming to you live from the West, Western Australia, Perth. Thank you so much for having us in your lovely state. Thanks for unlocking it for us. And John,
The Wild West.
We are doing a live show here.
Yes.
And we have got lots to cover. We are doing a deep dive live podcast. So if you like live podcasts and you like them long and dirty, you're in the right place. We can't do these podcasts without the wonderful help of Tao. Did you know, in 2021, Tao formalized its approach to ESG? That's environmental, social, and governance, allowing them to make a broader contribution and further align to areas that are important to the people that they protect. One of their core areas of focus is climate change and environment. And Tao is focused on helping reduce the impact of climate change for the benefit of all communities. That's Tao, T-A-L, ensuring this Australian life. Last financial year, Tao's operation continued to be carbon neutral and they undertook a series of building upgrades, allowing them to switch to 100% renewable energy for electricity by 2023. For more infos on Tao's approach to ESG, click the link in the show notes. So thank you, Perth, for coming out. Thank you to ING and BPAY. We'll share more about them later in the episode. But until then, Johnson, are you ready to pluck it?
We are indeed ready to pluck this chook.
Yes. Alrighty then. First question is from Debbie. Debbie, what have you got for us tonight?
Is buying a second property a good idea with rising interest rates?
Ooh, I might let John handle that.
Yes.
Okay. Yes, Debbie wants to go rogue, so
yeah.
You can
just
go for it.
We're going to have it out here, Debbie.
All right. So I've got a property that I live in at the moment. I am going to move overseas fairly soon. Really privileged to be able to do that with work. So have a few more allowances that are coming in the bank.
Okay.
And I'm just wondering if it's a good time to branch out and get a second investment property.
Okay. So you can rent out the house you're in now?
Correct.
Cash flow positive?
I'm hoping so.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, let's say yes for the conversation to roll. And you're living overseas with a higher income.
Yes.
And extra savings.
Hopefully.
Yes.
The other option is like travel a lot.
Yep. Okay. Either way, you've got that in your control.
Yep.
Okay. So your life is in a better cash flow position than potentially what it is now. So what's stopping us from investing?
I guess being more cash heavy with rising interest rates and potentially the travel option, so not wanting to hamstring myself with property in Australia while I'm in like a really good base for travel.
Okay.
Maybe I'm thinking quite small-minded. Maybe it will be fine because the two properties would take care of themselves and I'd be fine anyway.
Yeah, you sort of answered that in the sense that could your strategy involve that second property looking after itself yield-wise to factor in interest rate rises? Because we don't need to buy in a capital city with a 3% gross yield just trying to get the most capital growth we can. We could have a balanced property there with cash flow and yield, knowing that you can still travel overseas? Can you get lending while you're overseas? Depends on your industry and income and setup with that company. But ideally, you'd probably want to do that before you go away. If you come back 4 years, 5 years' time, that property's grown in value and it hasn't cost you a dime, would that be the outcome?
Yes.
Yeah.
Have you got a good buyer's agent to recommend?
Might be able to find one for you, Debbie. Yeah.
Well, love that. Debbie, quick question. What's your occupation?
I'm an engineer.
Awesome. What country are you relocating to?
USA.
Awesome. And how long do you intend to be in the US and A?
It's hopefully 2 years, hoping for more.
Awesome. I like the fact that you're thinking about when you are in the States and when you are traveling. If it was me personally, I would probably be more concerned if I am traveling and living abroad that I am cash heavy and I don't have to think I have to invest before I go away. And you can always buy homes. I mean, you can just save up lots of cash. And if you can't get lending here in 12 months' time, once the dust settles over there and you've got a pile of cash, you might be able to service a mortgage easier with some of the rent and some of the deposit. So I think you should absolutely almost vibe it out. How long until you leave?
4 months.
Okay.
But what I am worried about is just time. So if I act now, this would be the best time to buy that property because it would have that time to grow,
yes,
hopefully, by the time I want to do something with it.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm not too worried because as an engineer in the States, you'd probably be printing money for a bit.
But you can print money while she's got that asset.
That's right.
And this is the great thing about this is we've always disagreed on this one. Right, which is great, and no one's right, no one's wrong. It's you've got to sit there and wake up in the morning and say, which one am I more comfortable with?
So what I'll do, you've got 4 months. If you don't have a mortgage broker, Finex team are here. Chat with them, get a pre-approval happening, speak to a buyer's agent. If everything lines up, I'm of the view with my life and money, I go on a green, pause on an amber, stop on a red. If I do all this pre-approval and it's just too hard, I'm like, this is not meant to be. I'm not going to force this because you force stuff, things break. So maybe just walk down the road, get a pre-approval, look at your options, and because you will have a good income, you can probably service okay. But just factor in 6% as a interest rate just to be ultra conservative. So, yeah, the fact that you're asking the questions, you've got a good income, you can't wreck it. So, good on you. Give her a hand, everyone.
Hold on, Debbie.
Now, did you want a book? Yes, we've got The Psychology of Money. Yeah, this is an awesome book.
I love Sim, but we've run out.
Yeah, I know. Sorry. And you can see on the back of the books I'm giving away, I bought them from Dimmicks and I paid full retail. So you're all welcome. All right, Shannon.
Hello.
Thanks for coming back to another live event.
Thank you for having me.
No, I really appreciate you returning. What's your question, Shannon?
My question is, where do I start with 5K investing?
Okay. What do you think? So you've been to a live event before.
Yep.
What would you tell your best friend at the moment if they were to start, if you knew their goal? And I'm going to share your goal with everyone in a moment.
Okay.
Do you remember writing your goal on the question thing?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yep.
So what do you think would be a wise thing to do at this time?
I'd say just do it because it's a pretty bear investment market at the moment, but I have a bit of analysis paralysis at the moment.
Yeah, who has that? Who gets analysis paralysis? Yeah, I don't. I do the opposite. I go too hard too early and I leave a trail of crap behind me. So if there's a blend of us, it would be cool. You wrote that a goal of yours is investing and saving a healthy, I won't say the amount for your own privacy, but a healthy savings, like for a home deposit.
Yeah.
How long do you think you want to take until you buy a first home?
I'm looking at the moment. Cool. I don't have the amount that I have said that I want, but I'm not overly far off it.
Right. So if I was in your shoes, I actually wouldn't worry about allocating any money to any extra investments at the moment. I would, because you are close, I'll just focus on smashing out that home deposit.
Yep.
Speaking with your broker, getting that pre-approval happening, then getting into the home, get your cash flow and budget settled, and then set a timer on your phone in 6 months that, okay, it's been 6 months, I've been in the house, now I need to actually get my life back on track and start investing for the long term. Now, I will say, first home super saver scheme, have you considered that?
I have no idea what it is.
Okay, awesome. We'll put a link in the show notes to a YouTube video that explains the first home super saver scheme conceptually. And basically what it is, the federal government lets you put money into your superannuation and you don't lose it with negative investment returns, and then withdraw it to buy your first home to live in, and you can save up to about $6,000 in tax. So it's a strategy that you can do. And in the coming weeks, if you're listening to this, and we might get it put up, Rach, hi. Rachel and Nathan are up the back. They're part of our team. They are killing it. And JP is floating around. She's part of our team. She's organized all this. We did an episode today with the team at Everest Wealth, and we talk about the first home super saver scheme. We might see if we can get that up on Thursday. If we can't, we'll just delete this from the podcast. So consider that you can basically flush money through superannuation and save on tax. Amazing. Yeah, so I really think, who think that makes sense? Yeah. Who would start investing today regardless? Yes. Yeah. So the hands that we're raising, that we're seeing raised, that speaks to risk appetite and, you know, the comfort level. For me, my personality is, let's get the big rock done first, put all our energy into getting to that house as soon as possible. Then in 6 months' time, probably still going to be a bear market, and you're already investing with your superannuation, so you're not missing the investment world. So I'm personally focusing on that. But if you do have analysis paralysis, get in your home, get your budget settled, set a deadline where you need to start investing.
Amazing.
Awesome. Shannon, thanks for listening and coming up. Would you like a book? Grab The Psychology of Money or Never Split the Difference on Negotiation. Well, do you want that one as well?
No, I can't take both.
No, do it. Dare you. I don't care. Yeah, do it. Yeah. No, no. Take both. Shannon. Good I don't question. Care. Okay. We're going to take a quick break to let everyone go out and go to the bathroom, and there's a cash bar out there if you need to buy drinks. We'll be back right after this. I really want to thank ING and BPAY for getting behind our national tour. We honestly could not do it without them. Thinking about refinancing your home loan? ING could save you a heap. Search ING Loans, subject to credit approval and T&Cs. ING Bank Australia Limited, Australian Credit License 229823. To stay in control of your bill payments, use BPAY. With BPAY, you can pay your bills from the security of your online banking, choose which account to pay the bills, and even schedule payments for a time that suits you better. Say, after payday. Scheduled payments are subject to systems and funds availability. BPAY, see the PDS for further information.
If you're after personal financial advice, don't get it from a podcast. If you would like help based on your own personal situation, head over to sortyourmoneyout.com, click Get Help, and we'd be happy to introduce you to one of our trusted advisors. Our panel of advisors, mortgage brokers and accountants work with clients all over Australia so they can connect with you wherever you are. That's sortyourmoneyout.com and click Get Help.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why United Healthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Okay, we're back and we've got Adrian who's going to read a question. Adrian.
All right, thanks. Is there any value in spreading ETFs in multiple index companies such as between Vanguard and BetaShares?
Ooh, good question. Who here invests in ETFs? Yep. Oh, lots of people. Look at you investors go. I don't know. Do whatever you want next. No, okay. I think if we look at our investing, and I'll first use an example. You've mentioned BetaShares and Vanguard. So BetaShares has an A200 ETF, which we know is the top 200 Australian shares on the Australian Securities Exchange, and it's weighted. And weighted means that if you had $200, it's not $1 to every company. If CBA is 10% of the 200, your money, every dollar you put into that ETF, it's weighted that part of that dollar or $1,000 would be allocated to CBA. So it's a weighted 200. Vanguard have a VAS, which is Vanguard Australian Share Fund, which is an ETF. Anyone here invest in Vanguard? Yep. That is the top 300 Australian shares. Now, if you were to hold both just to get exposure to Australian shares, you're probably just going around in circles because the difference of the top 200 in A200 and VAS, you barely would have noticed the return of the last 100. You might have the view that I want to split money between Vanguard and BetaShares for business risks or whatnot. I think that risk is quite low given it's a custodian relationship. And a lot of people freak out when we talk about things that are chess sponsored and not chess sponsored. Who's seen stuff online about chess sponsorship? Yeah. Who gets their knickers in a knot if they can't invest via a chess sponsored broker? Yeah. Well, I'm about to unknot your knickers here because if you invest in an ETF, Alicia, and Alicia Atkin Radburn, she was on the podcast twice in the last 6 months. She's here. Yeah. She's going to come up and say hi soon. But if you are a firm purist believer that your investing has to be chess sponsored, sure, I get that if you're buying direct shares. But if you're buying ETFs, you don't have indirect ownership anyway. Yeah. So what's your problem? I don't know where we're going there. But to your question, tough crowd. But to your question, there are reasons why you may have different company ETFs. And I'll give you an example. In my own model portfolio, I've got my international exposure. I've got IVV, which is the BlackRock S&P 500 fund in the States. And I'm a big fan of just having ETFs and that are domiciled in Australia so I don't have to fill out annoying American tax forms. Like, how annoying. And then I use VEU, which is the All World X US Shares. So the reason you would go to different brands, for want of a better word, is to get a portfolio built the way that you want it, that you couldn't perhaps get a one-stop shop in a portfolio. Or if you've got a, you know, we've talked about Vanguard, you might have a Vanguard Diversified High Growth Fund ETF with 90% of your money. And I'm interested in the hydrogen industry. So I might then look at ETF securities and invest in one of their specialist funds just to have a bit of a satellite in my portfolio. Now, Adrian, you're a smart dude and does that help? And I know you may have been asking that maybe for the group, but any follow-up comments?
Yeah, no, I think you've pretty much hit the hammer on the nail there.
Yeah,
because it's more about the exposure. And I was thinking about, can you be over-leveraged in one company versus another? What's the likelihood of them, say, going completely out of business, which I think is very low.
Yeah.
But also it was a question for the room because I think it's something that people want to know.
Yeah, totally. And that's why we include these, because a lot of people ask that same type of question. And, you know, at the moment, has anyone seen in the paper in recent weeks, in the last couple of weeks, has anyone seen the news about spaceship having some issues, quote unquote. Yeah. So I don't think that – I'm not too concerned, quote unquote, that they're looking for capital raising as part of their business operations. My concern is, and why I don't use spaceship, is the overexposure to the tech industry is a bigger deal in my life than anything else. So, you know, all these investments, whether it is spaceship, whether it is Vanguard, whether it is BetaShares, whether it is BlackRock, all the money's in custody anyway. So it's no different to your superannuation fund. And I know there's probably 5% of you in the room here that are absolute purists who disagree, and that's fine. Do your investing your way that you're comfortable with. But I think in the main, the bigger problem is getting a well-diversified portfolio and focusing on shoveling money into that, living on less than you earn and pumping that portfolio. Splitting hairs doesn't have much of an outcome in my life. So thanks, Adrian.
Yeah, thank you, Glenn.
No worries. It's been a pleasure.
Always.
Always. Thanks, Adrian. Oh, would you like a book?
Yeah.
Amazon, so. Well, that's the one that I bought for Pidge the other day and I had it in the pile.
All right. Yeah. Thank you.
And thank John.
Yeah, thanks, John.
All right. Jacob's got a question. And what I might do, I might ask Josh DeBuehl from Finex to come up and then I might let John and Josh talk about this.
In the current market, what's your thoughts on fixing part of the mortgage interest rate? What is considered a good rate currently as the interest rate continues to rise?
Ooh. Thanks, Jacob, for that. So, Josh from Finext, you're one of our local event partners here, and thanks for supporting the podcast and all that we do. So, I'll hand over to John and you guys can have a bit of a chat around fixing interest rates and whatnot. And where's Charnel Mack? I'm just going to run because I want to tack this question onto that same segment.
What are the basics of purchasing a second property using equity and turning the first property into an investment?
Awesome. And thanks for listening to the podcast for many years. Appreciate it.
Okay, so first question about the fixing interest rate. If you're asking me this question today, I'll give you my personal opinion and then I'll give you what I say to clients because they are two different things. So personally, I wouldn't fix because that suits my strategy. So then what I say to clients is, what's your strategy? So look, long-winded answer, cut down really short, is it's a psychological question more so. Rates are going up. I think someone said before, we just don't know when and how much by. So it comes back.
That was
back, me. Oh, that was you. That's why I was looking at you. I was giving you the prompts. It comes back to your comfort level. So either way, in my opinion, what we're explaining to clients, Jake and I, is basically either way it's a gamble because you could lock in a fixed rate, which at the moment fixed rates are higher than variables, okay? And fixed rates are normally a precedent of where the market is going. So fixing an interest rate means you're locking in a rate and you're happy with that level of repayments. Variable, obviously, as you know, means it can go up or down, predominantly up in this next 12 months. So your comfort level is based on, would you prefer to start with a lower rate and ride the bumps on the way up, or would you prefer to lock in something higher and just set and forget about it? In terms of a good interest rate, and I guess this is where having access to a broker for your property finance and artistry from Uncle Glenn, you can sometimes have access to information that's not actually out yet. So as an example, we got two emails today from a couple of the major banks. They were advertising a decrease to some of their fixed rates starting from next week. So obviously the heading sounds really attractive. You're thinking, oh my God, they're lowering their fixed rates. So it's obviously a marketing grab to try and grab some money. But they're bringing out fixed rates for a four-year term at 4.99%. Now, look, ultimately, when we hear 4.99, we're thinking, oh, that's friggin' high. But anyone that's had a mortgage longer than 3 years would know that 4.99 for 4 years is actually pretty good. But then variable-wise, people are like, yeah, but I'm still getting, you know, 3.1 or 2.74, which you can still qualify for today. So why would I lock in 4.99 for 4 years? You're freaking crazy. So it comes back to your strategy and your comfort level, okay? We've got plenty of clients. We had a lady today sign up for a fixed rate at 4.74. She's like, look, I'm happy with that.
I'm comfortable with my budget. I don't want to think about it every month when the rates keep going up. That's where I want to lock it in. So, like I said, my personal preference is no, I wouldn't, because my strategy doesn't adapt to that. But your strategy may. And I guess if you're completely unsure, you could split the difference and go half and half. So that's the other answer to that question. You could legitimately go half fixed, half variable to please both sides of your personality or your strategy. And that way you're going to be right and wrong all at the same time. So there you go. Not the most easiest answer, but if I had to take a pick, I would say go variable, because contrary to timing is probably the crucial thing. We fixed most of our clients last year. A lot of people got fixed rates, you know, 1.99% for 4 or 5 years, and they are loving it. But now you're in the fives and sixes for that sort of term. So it's just a timing question. But historically, variable allows you to be flexible and nimble. And I think I was having a chat with someone at the front. I can't remember your name, sorry. But I was basically saying with any strategy, if you can keep it as nimble and as flexible as possible, it allows you to pivot should things change. And that's what a variable rate allows you to do. So it's another little spit to it. Do you have any differences?
That's good. No, look, I absolutely support everything you've said there. A couple of things maybe to consider in that analysis is, do I have excess cash? And do I want to sit some in an offset account against that? Because when we've got a fixed rate, we probably can't do that, or as a maximum, isn't it, that you can sit in a fixed?
Most banks don't allow you to do it. There are three or four lenders where you can still 100% offset a fixed, yeah. But most popular is variable with offset, yeah.
Yeah. So if you've got a large chunk of cash, then variable is generally a better option. Over time, variable always beats fixed, in my opinion, and my evidence of basically what's happened. It's a little bit like trying to speculate the property market and say, I'm going to wait 12 months and then I'll buy in at the bottom of the market, and that invariably doesn't come. So do what's in your control now. But yeah, as Josh said, we factor in some increases, but we can roll with the punches, know our cash flow management plan, and it's a sleep at night factor to have a fixed loan. But you are very backed into a corner for that period of time, and not as fluid, eh?
Yeah, just not as flexible. And I guess it kind of segues into the second question about, I think it was using your equity to buy a second property, having a variable loan, coming back to the strategy, if that was a future thought, allows you to do, I think John mentioned it, about having an offset account. Because one of the common, and not mistakes, but can be a mistake after the fact, is when you buy your first property, someone was talking before about paying down your loan as quick as you can. But then 10 years later, you want to turn that into an investment and you just shot yourself in the foot from a tax strategy point of view. So ideally, if that is a long-term plan, and John would probably be accustomed to this, if you want to build equity to then buy another property which you're then going to live in, so your first property becomes an investment, you need to put your money in an offset account, because you're going to achieve the same thing of reducing your interest on your home, which is the ultimate goal, right? That's what you want to do. You want to reduce or minimize your interest. You want to beat the bank. So you can do that one of two ways. You pump it directly into the loan account itself, reduce the balance, or you pump it into a separate account, an offset account, and it reduces your interest cost. So you achieve the same thing. But by utilizing the offset account, which sits side by side, it frees that capital up to be then used as a deposit on your purchase of your own home, so the next property that you're using, without having to then take it back out of the loan. Because if you do that, this is not tax advice, I'm not an accountant, but you're not meant to, I'm sure some people do, but you're not meant to then claim that amount of capital on your tax, because you've used that money to buy your own home. So I guess in terms of having the variable loan, you keep that offset account side by side, pump the money into that, pull that money out, put it as a deposit on your future home or your new home in the future when you buy it, and you only pay the minimum towards your current loan. Just pay the minimum. You put your extra in the offset and you utilize that towards your new home. There's no point paying an extra $100,000 off your current loan, which is going to become an investment, when you could have used that towards a home loan, which is not tax deductible. So that's the sort of strategy. And then there's two different ways you can do it, which comes into, you know, cross-collateralizing or standalone properties, which is usually the recommended strategy, in where you can split your funding to keep both properties separate, have them with different lenders, and maximize the strategy as well. So that's the sort of the quick part, which I'm sure you'll probably agree to or add on to as well.
Yeah. So Mr. Squiggle over here. We've got an owner-oc that we're transitioning to investment and we want to upgrade to our new owner-oc. It's pretty common, isn't it? We want to leapfrog into a better location or a better dwelling, right? Who's in the midst of doing that or wants to do that at some stage? Yeah. I'll tell you something for nothing. Actually, they're paid for something tonight, didn't they? So, but anyway. You should have thought of that and planned for that before you bought the first one. And hopefully you've done that, right? Now, exactly what Josh is saying is, well, if we knew that we're going to leapfrog into that, what we would have done is maybe even went interest only there for a period of time, or at least had that offset that Josh mentioned. Keep that cash heavy and then chuck a whole bunch of cash into that home that's going to be your owner-occupier for longer. And that's bad debt according to the banks, whereas this will eventually be good debt, so you want to have that debt high, which you mentioned, okay? So depending on the period of that, and I'm just making up numbers, let's say that's 2 years. If we went interest only there and just pumped a whole heap of cash into that, we've got a owner-occupier that we can have an offset account and we can be interest only, can't we?
You can.
Right, we can be interest only, but you might see the interest rates and say P&I maybe, but put massive amounts of cash into there and that then forms a deposit on this and then you've got maximum tax deductions over there, okay? So you're keeping yourself fluid to not be backed into the corner to say, well, hang on a minute, I have to use equity from there to buy my new owner-occupier, and that's what so many people do. They use equity to buy their second home that they're going to live in. What's wrong with that? Well, they're essentially borrowing 100%, 102 or 3 when you include stamps, to buy your owner-occupier that you can't tax deduct. And it's not all about tax savings, but if we can get a win on the way in because we've used cash here and some tax benefits here, especially for all you miners and truck drivers that are on 300 grand a year, right, that's big stuff. That's a big deduction that we can claim over here. Yeah?
No, exactly right, John. And I think one of the people that are up here before said, oh, I'm building our home, but it's not our forever home. So I think we get that question a lot from people. We're buying our first home, but it's not our forever home. So if you're saying that from the beginning, then, yeah, have the right strategy in place. That's pretty simple. Yeah.
Awesome. Thanks, Josh and Jake from Finex. And thanks for your question. I'm going to invite Alex Luck from Everest Wealth, one of our local event partners here, to have a chat about these next couple of questions. And I thought I would start with Ben Tui.
So my question is, how do you know if your asset allocation is correct given your goal, age, time horizon, risk tolerance and income?
Anything else you want to know?
Well, it's more around, you know, you don't know what you don't know. So you have a portfolio and you set it up and you might see an advisor and he might give you advice. But until you sort of pressure test it, how do you know that you got the allocation right? Or later down the track, in my personal circumstance, I saw an advisor, he loaded him up with 16 ETFs. And 2 or 3 years down the track, I'm thinking, this is a lot of paperwork to keep track of. 16 feels too much to me. Why would a professional give me that many ETFs when ultimately they're kind of overlapping a lot?
Yeah, you'd have to ask him about that one. I'm not quite sure. I thought the best way to potentially answer this is to maybe talk about in regards to a super fund. Would that be okay, Ben? So in regards to, understanding your asset allocation and if it is correct for your goals. So again, if we're referring to a super fund, which is largely going to fund your retirement, most people want to have as much money as they possibly can in retirement. So therefore, you potentially want your investment along the way to make as much money as it possibly can. Now, if you're in your 20s, 30s, 40s, even 50s, it's going to be quite a long time before you're going to have access to this money. So let's just say, for example, you're going to get access at 65 and let's say you're 25 years old, 35 years old, or even 45 years old, that's at least 20 years away. Now, when you're doing any sort of form of investing, typically shares and property, if you hold them for 10 years, will outperform cash. Okay, so that's obviously quite a simplistic example. But if you're then thinking about, okay, with my super, I'm 25 years old. I've currently, say, got 50% in cash and 50% in shares and property. maybe because my investment time horizon is a lot longer than 10 years, I may want to look to increase my exposure to growth assets, so increase the exposure to shares and property, because I know that over the long term that's going to give me more money in my retirement, which is then going to meet my goal of having as much money as I possibly can to enjoy retirement.
I just had a look while that question was going on. My own portfolio with my financial advisor, I've got 10 different investment options and a mix between managed funds and ETFs. Now, and this is sidetracking.
Let's do it.
But it really depends on how they were setting that up. So, for example, the platform that I use, or the advisor uses, it's what they call a model portfolio. And, you know, everyone will have a different way that they manage their clients' money, right? So it can feel overwhelming. And I actually told them, can you turn off every bit of correspondence? I don't want to see it. Just give me a 6-monthly report. And they've just built a portfolio based on an asset allocation. Now, you said you're 42?
Yeah.
Yep. I fundamentally believe that anyone under 50, and I'd appreciate your advice or opinion on this, anyone under 50 with their super should get to a point with their education and understanding to have an asset allocation of at least 70% growth.
Yeah.
Because we know that we can't touch it for at least 10 years, right? But when it comes to saving for kids' education and whatnot, well, if we need the money in 10 years, well, we might just back it off and have a 50-50 allocation.
Yeah, you may do. Again, I guess the other thing which comes into it, which I didn't touch on, is I guess your own personal risk tolerance. So whilst you may understand, I guess, the literature and look at the numbers and look at how everything's performed historically and stuff like that, it's got to also always pass the sleep test, which may be, look, you know, I understand that I should go, you know, full 100% growth because my timeline is 20 years, but to be honest, I'm just not comfortable with that level of volatility, which again is perfectly fine because at the end of the day, you've got to be able to, sleep at night and make sure you're comfortable with it as well.
A follow-up question for Ben. Are you talking conceptually, have you got money outside super that you want to put to work?
Yeah, I got about 400K outside super, yeah.
Okay, cool. Can I have some?
Yeah. How much would you like?
I don't need much. I just need a new boat engine, so 40,000. So you've got money outside super. It honestly goes back to what are your goals for that money?
Essentially, my goal for that money is that my son is financially independent, so he can do whatever career he wants and he doesn't have to decide on a career that's related to income. So if he wants to do glass blowing that pays him zero, he's got like passive income to do what he wants. Yeah.
That's awesome. And this is I'm more interested.
Can I be your son? That sounds good.
It would be awkward, but we can make that happen. Yeah, sure.
Yeah, it could work.
How old is your son right now?
He's 7.
Awesome. I think your son is a very lucky young man. And not because of the money, because his dad's thinking about this crap. Like if you had $10,000 put aside for him, he's an awesome young man because your dad's thinking about you, right? Yeah. So I think it is obviously not needed for categorically, 12, 13 years?
Yeah, at least.
At least, right?
Maybe 17 to 30, yeah.
Yeah. So the money needs to go to work. Yeah. And the question is, how do we get it to work so you can still sleep at night? And then how do we get it to work in the most tax-effective long-term fashion? Because I would also hypothesize that there could be an argument for how old, you're 40, 50, 60, like a separate super account just for that money in dad's name or some crazy strategy that needs a whiteboard and not a stage at a podcast event.
Fair enough. But also if I could add into that as well, it's and then also from an administrative perspective as well, something that you're comfortable with and it's easy to manage too.
Yeah. As a single dad, like I've got zero time to like muck around with like lots of fiddly things, which is why I want something set and forget. So.
And where's the money at the moment? Is it in cash?
No, definitely not. So I've got my emergency fund, but basically it's 50% in sort of Vanguard high growth, and then I've got 30% in kind of dividend generating ETFs, and then I've got
15% in property and maybe 5% in defensive, like gold and bonds. Yeah.
Yeah, so you really switched onto it. I think the bigger considerations here that you need to chat with someone is around the estate planning piece. You know, if you checked out early or whatnot and you just wanted to make sure that all your estate planning stuff is...
Yeah, oh, that's all squared away. Yep, will all of that sort of gear, yeah. So.
Yeah, so, I mean, if it's okay, it's okay. I mean, you're probably comfortable with it. And I think it goes back to... You know, if you when we were talking before, I don't know if it was recording. When we get down to splitting hairs, my mind easily goes down to, well, you've got to make sure you're rebalancing and not overweight, and that's why the portfolio in a box is good, because it's rebalanced quarterly automatically, like your Vanguard thing. But I think there's nothing that I can add that would make it better for you other than to maybe get another professional just to run their eyes over the situation if you felt comfortable to.
Yeah, that sounds good. Thanks.
But give Ben a hand, because that's such an amazing thing. Thank you so much, Ben. I don't have any books left, but I've got a tote bag. Yeah, that's right.
This works with my outfit.
It does, it does. It really brings out the eyes. But yeah, I mean, yeah, give him a hand. But I will add to that, just in terms of the estate planning piece, there could be a thought about maybe an investment bond or something. I don't know. There's lots going on there, because you've got to think long term.
And depending on income and tax rates and stuff like that.
So it's really...
But from an estate planning perspective as well, it's not too bad.
Okay, Fiona.
Okay, my question. If you could only have one type of personal insurance, which would you pick and why? And also, would it be within super or not? But I think I already know the answer.
Oh, you don't already know the answer.
Yeah, and this is, well, it's...
I know it's personally independent to everyone else.
Yeah, and the reason we do this stuff, if you know the answer, I know most of the answers that I say. Well, I try and make them up. Don't sue me. It's for other people who might genuinely not have thought of it. So awesome. Okay.
All right, I'll try and flesh it out a little bit as well. So there's four types of personal insurance that you can have, starting with life insurance, which is probably the one that most people have heard of before, which effectively, if you were to pass away, a lump sum of money is provided to your beneficiaries. So whether that's your spouse or kids, for an example. You may have life insurance if you have dependents or you have debts. If you don't have those sorts of things, then life insurance is potentially not important to you at this point in time. The next one is another lump sum cover, which is called total and permanent disability cover. This effectively is paid out if you become totally and permanently disabled and you're effectively unlikely to ever be able to work again. So again, similar to life insurance, but you haven't passed away this time, but you receive a lump sum of money in that event. The next one is what's called trauma or critical illness insurance. This pays out if you suffer a critical illness, such as a heart attack, cancer, and stroke, are sort of the main three. There's about 50 conditions which are covered under that contract. And if you are diagnosed with any of these, again, you are paid a lump sum of money for that. And then the final one is income protection. Income protection is a little bit different from the other three, because the other three, you get paid a lump sum or a one-off payment. Income protection is a monthly payment for every month that effectively that you can't work because you're sick or injured. The difference between, I guess, total and permanent disability cover and income protection is income protection will pay you if you are temporarily incapacitated. So you break your leg and you can't work for six months. You might get paid after your waiting period of 1 month. So you get paid for 5 months of that. It also pays in the event of total and permanent disability as well, depending on how long your benefit period is.
So what are you taking if you had to pick one?
So if I had to take one, I'd probably take the last one, which would be income protection, because it covers you in pretty much all situations other than death.
Right. And let's actually ask Fiona, do you have kids?
Yes.
How many kids?
Two.
Do you have a partner?
Yes.
How many?
One, I think.
Awesome. So in Fiona's situation, does your answer change? Because I've got a strong view on this.
Are you the primary caretaker right now, or are you working for... No, okay, you're the primary.
I work part-time.
Work part-time.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, it's hard.
Okay, so my categorical view with conviction, if you're a single person and you had to pick one of the four types of cover, income protection, you want to protect your income all day long and you want to do that outside of super, it's a better policy, tax deductible, blah, blah, blah. If you had financial dependence and you had to choose, I would be going the death cover because at least, at the very least, if a parent or guardian was to die prematurely, at least there's money for the family left over. If there's an unfortunate incident and they can't work, at least we've got some social safety nets. They're not as good. At least we've got friends and family. But you can categorically, if you die, it's really hard to cough up $800,000, $1 million to replace income. That's my view.
Yeah, and I think that's a perfectly logical view. I guess my view would potentially be, again, possibly still the income protection because if someone is then becomes totally and permanently disabled in that situation, they're still alive and we still have to look after them. And whilst there are obviously social safety nets in place for that, they aren't particularly great. But, yeah. I mean, there is no right or wrong. I mean, effectively have both is probably the answer.
That's right. And
then the funding, she wanted to know about the funding.
Yeah, well, I think death cover in super because in Australia, if you have death cover in your super fund, the super fund claims that premium on tax. If it's paid out to financial dependents, there's no tax paid. And you can effectively salary sacrifice into superannuation to cover the cost of the insurance, which basically means your death cover is tax deductible and it's tax free to dependents, whereas your TPD cover in superannuation, the premium's tax deductible, but there will be some tax paid if it had to be paid out to you. So death cover is the absolute thing in super most of the time is better.
Yeah, definitely.
But get advice.
Yeah.
It's like I think I'm right, but check with your advisor. all right, Fiona, what you're going to do, this might seem awkward, but if you can type your address in there, I'm going to post you a copy of The Psychology of Money via Amazon and I'll gift wrap it. I'll tell them it's a gift. So there we have it. Alex from Everest Wealth, thanks for looking after all our listeners and people in the West and the East and everywhere around Australia.
No worries. Thanks for having me.
No worries. Cheers.
Nice work, Alex.
Thank you. No worries. I'll get that to you probably in like a year. Like I'll forget and then I'll be like, oh, crap, I've got to do that.
There'll be a new edition out by then.
That's right. All right. Look, there's some okay. We're going to start to wrap up the night. Is everyone still okay?
Yeah.
Happy to be here? Yes. Yes. Yes.
Natalia bought me a beer before.
Well, she gave me the beer. I'm like, I don't drink.
Yeah. Oh, so it was seconds.
Yeah.
Wow.
I'm going to ask a friend of the podcast, Alicia Atkin Radburn, to come to the stage. Give her a hand. Aiken. All right, wait. Whatever.
We were so close. It's Alicia Aitken Radburn, but we're good.
What did I say, Atkin?
Yeah, it happens all the time.
Hey, you're still here.
There's a lot of champagne going.
So Alicia was on the pod. Who heard the episodes with Alicia? Yeah, look at them. Yeah. Okay, we've got a question from Athea Casp, and your question is?
Yeah, I'm in my early 30s, and I feel like I'm left behind. How do I deal with it?
Ooh, does anyone here feel like they're behind? And before Alicia answers that, can I feel like I'm behind. Can I just ask you a couple of questions? That's a nice rock on your finger. So you're married?
We just got married, yeah.
Oh, congratulations. Awesome. And what's the living arrangement?
Basically, we live in my house at the moment. Yeah.
And you're a owner, you don't rent?
I own my house and I have two more properties coming in.
Okay. Okay, that's cool. I just wanted some context. Are there any specific areas that you may feel left behind in?
Well, like investment, like long-term, yeah, in terms of that.
That's awesome.
It's funny because that was my question last year and I still feel like that's my current question.
Yeah, that's interesting. So, Alicia, can you solve all our problems with your wisdom, your champagne wisdom?
I think it's very generous that you've brought up a person who's done 3 reality TV shows who isn't 30 yet to answer this question.
Whatever.
But you're right. It's something that we all feel. And firstly, I know this is probably going to be a little bit of a naff answer, but and it's something we've spoken about, Glenn, on the podcast. I think just by you being in this room tonight and last year means that you are in touch with your financial goals and what you want for your future. So I think that deserves congratulations in and of itself and to everybody in the room tonight. Can I do it?
I don't care.
Applause.
Yeah.
And give yourself an applause for being here. I'd also say just I think myself, like a lot of people in this room tonight, not to say that we don't love you the most, Glenn and John, but I'm a part of a lot of different financial Oz finance communities and, you know, not cheating on you guys, sorry.
You're a guest here.
I'm just like, you guys can leave the stage. It's me now. And by doing that, you are always upskilling and educating yourself. And from what I've witnessed in those communities, there are such a diverse range of people in these communities. And when you say early 30s, like my mum's in her, reaching her mid-60s. And as much as it's not something that I would like to see for her, I probably have more financial literacy than my mum, which is upsetting in a way. But I think that it is something about, you know, my millennial money and what we're seeing in the finance spaces that is allowing millennials and Gen Zs to become more financially literate. So there's that. And then I would say to move into more specifics, there's 2 things. Identify your goal, as Glenn laid out for us, and put a plan into action, whatever that may be. I think we, all of us in this room, are able to identify those things that will propel us through our goals. We could all identify them tonight. And the one last thing that I would say is a bit of a different one, but sometimes you need to take it back to basics with mindset. So if you are in a space where you are feeling a bit disillusioned, you're feeling a bit lost, and you just feel like you're not actually being able to achieve your goals. I remember I was two years ago, I was in Bali. I took myself to Bali for a month because I was just bereft.
A like, bit of an eat, pray, love.
It was. Yeah. It was absolutely an eat, pray, love. And you know what I did? I was like, I just haven't been able, I feel like I've not achieved anything in my life. Like I was so done with it. And I decided I wanted to learn how to ride a scooter. And that was my goal. And I took myself and I did some scooter lessons. And you know what? I'm probably going to go back to Bali in the next 6 months. And I can ride a scooter. I might need another lesson. But sometimes it's just about setting a very, very basic goal and showing ourselves that we can achieve that and you feel awesome. So that's it.
Yeah, awesome. Thank you so much well for the said. Question. I just wanted to add one thing, and it was a loaded comment for the example that as humans, we've all got things that other people want. So we all see others and their thing, and we've all got a thing that others want. You know what I'm saying? Or whatever. So the example is when we're comparing ourselves, we can only compare ourselves to the us of yesterday. How far we've come in our relative situation, because you've got an awesome new husband, Nick, and I can see he loves you very much, and you've got a beautiful ring and you're having a great time as newlyweds. There are people in the room who may have met you tonight who aren't married, who see your ring and they see you and they think that they're behind. So life is truly equal and we've all got our thing. And I've said this on podcasts before. I'm going back up to my room tonight alone without a wedding ring and it'd be nice to be married one day and all that stuff. But I see that and I can't see your good relationship and feel that I'm missing out or I'm behind because I'm just comparing myself to how far I've come in other areas of my life.
Mm, well done.
So,
can I add something as well? Just
let's
because
do it.
We're all doing it. I'm not trying to solve the problem either, but what may help is if you both aspire to have a target to live in your own home that you both contribute to. Because you may be having this feeling of, well, I'm in Nick's home, Nick's got the properties, like he's given me a ring and we're married, but it's all his sort of thing in your own mind. So can we work towards 3 years' time having a home together that you both contribute to and maybe that gives you a little bit of comfort. So
there you go. Thanks, John. There you go. And I've just given you both the Lucky Door prize from Everest Wealth. So there we go.
You're lucky.
Now, is everyone okay if we do one more?
Yes.
Yeah. So within all that, we didn't answer some questions earlier in the night. If you have a question that you wanted to ask and you're brave enough to say it on the podcast, please feel free to raise your hand. Okay, the first hand I saw was Jade. Okay, Jade, what's your question?
Hi. First of all, I want to say thanks because we're with Everest Wealth and you gave us that recommendation and they're lovely.
Ah,
yeah,
well done.
Yeah. So thank you.
Well planted, Alex.
And it's piggybacking off a question over here, but you mentioned before about regional areas and I wanted to know your opinion about the Southwest in terms of investment properties.
Southwest of WA?
We're not in freaking Kansas, Dorothy. Busselton.
Oh, I did the Busselton Ironman about 10 years ago. It's a beautiful spot. And you know, it's one of those places where you go to and you're like, I actually wouldn't mind a house here because I think it's got some upside to it. I absolutely like that place. It's within reasonable earshot to Capital City. It's landlocked. So they're two big ticks for me. It has had some growth already. But, yeah, I wouldn't go – this is my personal opinion. I wouldn't go too far out from the water if I was buying there. But, yeah, affordability, I don't mind that at all. You've got to look at industry. Like we talk about PIE, population, infrastructure, economy – we look at those three on a macro level and see, answer that for each of those independently, not emotionally. Oh, I did an Ironman there. I just love it. Like it was my first born sort of thing. Like we've got to get away from that and look at the logic.
All right. I'm up the backseat bandits. Michelle, hello.
I just want to get your thoughts on refinancing in this current market where interest rates are rising. Would you wait to see how it, like the climb and what it gets to and then refinance or think about doing it now? Because I feel like I'm considering it, but also am I struggling up an uphill mountain where I could refinance, but then it just keeps climbing. So then what would you think about that?
Yeah, okay. So we need a bit of context around that, and it's probably a mortgage broker question, which I sort of am, but I don't practice it. I think... are we getting equity out in the refi or are we just simply going to a better loan option? So there's two separate conversations there. So can we just quickly clarify, are we getting equity out?
I'm thinking about it. So I've been in my place for quite a few years now and there is some equity there and I have some savings too. So
okay. So high level, stop thinking about it and get it out. Because, and not trying to sound harsh, but once we've got it out, it's ours. If the market that you're in dips, we no longer have the ability to get that same amount of equity out. If it rises, then we can get extra equity out. But at least we've secured what we've already got now, right? Refinancing to another lender is more of a mortgage broking question to see, well, which lender's going to be more suitable for me at that time based on my income and my industry and all of that. So that might be something that the boys want to answer.
Do you have a mortgage broker?
I do, but I could look elsewhere.
It's not a loaded question.
No, but you've just got to look at the interest rate you're paying and say, well, why do I want to refinance? Am I getting hurt by the banks now, the lender I've got, because it's not comparable to what else is out there? Am I just looking online and seeing this targeted media that is clickbait? Have I actually spoken to my broker about what's going to be the best option for me?
I reckon, Johnny, like, regardless of the economic climate, as good financial housekeeping, you need to come up for air every so many years with your broker and go back to your same broker and just go, hey, can we just run our eyes over this?
Yeah, every 12 months, regardless.
Yeah.
Yep. And when you're building a portfolio, it's imperative. You've got to check in on your values, check in on your finance structure, check in on your whole life, your tax position, whatever. Like, that's an overhaul every 12 months.
Yeah, sweet. All right, one last one, because we do need to let people go home. I'm going to go here. Question from Karis.
So when diversifying your property portfolio interstate, how do you manage rental risk? So making sure the right tenants are in there, making sure the, you know, updates are just and things like that.
Mm. Good question, Karis. And I think a lot of it is a mindset thing. It's like, well, it's 4 hours away by plane, so there's a bit more risk associated. But really, is there? Is it different from buying 3 or 4 suburbs away? Am I really going to drive past it? So I think it's in the recruitment of your team of people. So A, if you're choosing a buyer's agent to buy on your behalf, they're giving you some research on the location, and they're talking about vacancy rates, and they're talking about what the upside is in the area that you're buying and not just seeing a glossy brochure. And then once you've bought the property, or just before you've bought it, you're interviewing property managers to make sure you're recruiting the best possible manager for your team, because a bad tenant is a bad property manager that's a bad owner because they recruited that property manager, right? So it's quite simple, but in our mind it becomes fearful or complicated because it's over the other side of the country per se. Does that help?
Yeah, I would personally, I haven't crossed that bridge yet or that border. I think I would have more confidence at least flying to the area first, getting a vibe for the area, making sure you've got a good property manager. I got to wrap up.
Yeah. Look, and it comes down to your risk profile. It's like, well, I can buy property sight unseen because that's what I've done before. You might not want to do that, so you might jump on a plane and go across and have a look. Does that solve the issues of your world? Probably not, but you get to look around and kick the dirt and jump back on the plane again. Like,
and you can't claim those expenses anymore in your tax return. No. So
You've just got to do what's in your control and tick off what's annoying you.
Cool. Okay, Perth, thank you so much for coming out. And thank you to not Taylor, Sarah, is it? Sarah Taylor, thanks for coming. Sarah didn't know what the hell she was coming to tonight. She was dragged along by a friend.
In the front seat.
Josie was just like, hey, come to an event with us. So. Right. She didn't even say what it was. So.
You know, Josie works on 2 million acres of land.
Wow. That's awesome. 2 million acres.
2 million acres is a lot of land.
So thank you, Perth. You're being real. I've been Glenn. This has been John. Thank you so much for coming out tonight. Give yourselves a hand.
We acknowledge the Awabakal people, traditional custodians of the land on which our studio sits and pay respects to their elders, past, present, and emerging. We extend that respect to Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples who may listen to our podcast. My Millennial Money supports a variety of charities, and we encourage you to consider giving as part of your overall financial strategy. If you would like some giving options, or if you're unsure about which charity you can support, head to mymillennial.money/charities for more info. This podcast is for education and entertainment purposes. Any advice is general financial advice only, which does not take into account your objectives, financial situation, or needs. Because of that, you should consider if the advice is appropriate to you and your needs before acting on the information. If you do choose to buy a financial product, read the product disclosure statement, target market determination, and obtain appropriate financial advice tailored to your needs. Simo Interactive Proprietary Limited, the publisher of the podcast, and Glenn James are authorised representatives of Money Sherpa Proprietary Limited, which holds financial services license 451289.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.